My name is Mark Jackson. Good morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I'm the Executive Director of Community Engagement here at Syracuse University, and I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging, with respect, the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, and indigenous people on whose ancestral land Syracuse University now stands. I am joined today by Frank Moses, the Director of Community Engagement and Organizational Advancement for Focus Greater Syracuse. This morning's program is a collaboration with Focus Greater Syracuse as a part of our continued partnership. Frank, would you like to say a few words?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. Just wanted to take an opportunity to thank Syracuse University for partnering with us, and also for those folks that don't know about Focus, it stands for Forging Our Communities United Strength. We host different programs. The Focus Forums are one of them. I'm really happy to partner with Syracuse University on that, as well as our Citizens Academy. If you don't know about Citizens Academy, it's an 8-week program that's designed to have folks want to engage about learning about our local and county government. And we probably will have applications coming out late May, June. How many folks are an alum of that program here? Wonderful. It's all about building capacity to engage more. And so when that comes out, we'll reach out to you so you can reach out to the rest of the community to take advantage of that program. And wanted to thank everyone for being here. And Mark will introduce our speakers.
All right. Thank you, Frank. Now I'm honored to introduce this morning's speakers, Dan Seberg and Megan Stewart. Dan Seberg is Chief Executive Officer of the Multi-Regional Rescue Mission Alliance of Syracuse that serves thousands of individuals a year with programs in Syracuse, Auburn, Binghamton, and Utica. Under his leadership, the organization is one of the first missions to rapidly expand new progressive housing models and is placing more than 700 people a year into permanent housing. Dan holds an undergraduate degree from SUNY Cortland and a master's degree in social work from Syracuse University. He has spoken nationally regarding the issues that people experiencing homelessness face. He also has addressed the most effective solutions needed to assist these individuals. Locally, Dan chairs the board of the Housing and Homeless Coalition of Central New York, collaborating with homelessness task forces and boards. He is a proven leader that builds consensus among stakeholders and keeps the needs of those served by the rescue mission at the very core of its programs. Megan Stewart is director of the Housing and Homeless Coalition of Central New York. She has been serving as director since June of 2018. HHC serves the city of Syracuse, the county of Onondaga, and the city of Auburn, and the county of Cayuga, and the county of Oswego, as part of the HUD continuum of care. It is a community coalition to address homelessness and housing vulnerability through informal networking and formal linkages between homelessness service providers and other public and private human service providers. Prior to being named to the leadership role, Megan was the performance specialist at the Housing and Homeless Coalition. She has worked in the field of addressing housing and homelessness for 10 years. Megan earned her executive master's degree in public administration from Syracuse University. Please join me in welcoming Dan and Megan to the stage.
Hi, I will be going first this morning. So, as the introduction stated, I'm Megan Stewart, Director of Housing and Homeless Coalition. Been the director there since June of 2018. I've worked in housing and homelessness since 2010, working from frontline case management for people who are homeless up to where I am now. So it's been quite a journey. So I'd like to give a brief overview of the coalition, what it does. I've got some statistics that you're probably all interested in what homelessness looks like in our community. So, like the introduction said, we cover Onondaga, Oswego, and Cayuga counties. And really what we want to do is start a community dialogue around ending homelessness. There's about 50 organizations who are member organizations of the coalition across those three counties. So we're pretty large. This is just a structured outline of what we look like. So we have our HHC body, our advisory board. We have more work groups and committees than you could ever count. We're always making new ones. And a lot of these committees are focusing on specific strategies to end homelessness or housing vulnerability, or to assess homelessness in specific populations. So we have a veteran work group that their sole purpose is to look at veterans experiencing homelessness, chronic homelessness work group. Those are the people who are continuously chronic. I'd just like to throw in too, I think defining our terms is really important when we're talking about homelessness. When I use the term homeless, it means someone who is literally sleeping outside or staying in an emergency shelter, like at the rescue mission. Housing vulnerable is what you'd think of as couch surfing, people staying with family, being evicted. That is what I will refer to as housing vulnerable, just to make it very clear. So when I give a statistic about homeless people, an annual date, that'll be people literally outside or in a shelter. I think that's just very important so we're all on the same page. So we act as HUD's continuum of care, and what that means is we have to operate the continuum of care. The continuum of care is an initiative by Housing and Urban Development to create strategies in communities to end homelessness. We have to have a full meeting, at least semi-annually. We meet every other month. We have to evaluate the outcomes of projects. So there are projects all over the three counties that are funded through the continuum of care dollars, and we monitor and oversee those to make sure that they're performing well and using the HUD dollars appropriately. We have to establish and operate a centralized or coordinated entry system. I'll get into that a little later of what that means. And then we have HMIS, the Homeless Management Information System. This is probably one of the most impressive things we do. So 98% of homeless providers across the three counties enter data into this system. So we're able to collect all of the data on anyone experiencing homelessness, run reports, get a real good capture of what homelessness looks like in this community on a daily basis. We're able to look at that. And then we have planning. So some of you might have heard of our point in time count. That's one day in the last 10 days of January. Thank you, HUD. We have to go out in the cold and do a three-county canvas of anyone who's experiencing homelessness. We're essentially out there trying to count who's homeless. So that's one day a year. And the continuum of care, with great partnership from the rescue mission, are responsible for making sure that count happens. We have to provide an annual gaps in needs survey. So we're surveying people who are experiencing homelessness or have experienced homelessness to really look at what do they identify as gaps and needs in our service delivery system. And then once a year, like I said, the continuum of care funnels money into the community. Once a year, the continuum of care is responsible for submitting a three county-wide application to HUD to receive those dollars. It's a competitive grant. So the better we perform, the more money our community gets. I think we're up to about $9.8 million that we're receiving right now for those three counties. So our current goals, so we have a whole 10-year plan. I'm not gonna walk you through it. It's about 10 pages long. But some places we're really focusing on right now are connecting with healthcare providers. There is a large correlation between high utilizers of Medicaid, so people who are frequently visiting the emergency room, and people experiencing homelessness. So we're working with healthcare providers on how can we address those issues. We're creating a more sound coordinated entry system, which prioritizes the hardest to serve people for housing, and then creating more safe and affordable housing for our community. So those are our big priorities for, I would say, 2019. So coordinated entry. So we are required to have this system, and what it does is it assesses and prioritizes people based on need for housing. So we have a number of housing projects in this community. What we're trying to do is make sure those most in need of housing get those beds. There's less beds than there are people who need them. So we have to create a system that's as equitable as we can make it to make sure people are assessed and getting into the right type of housing. This is just a little picture of how that system works. So someone who is experiencing homelessness would go to Department of Social Services or call 211 to get access into emergency shelter. They're then either, and this is I think the part that people don't realize, they're either what we call diverted out of homelessness, which means if they have friends, family, or just need a back rental payment to keep them from entering homelessness, the Department of Social Services will make that happen. They'll connect to community resources and try and keep as few people out of emergency shelter as possible. You can't imagine, maybe some of you can, I shouldn't assume that, but the disruption that entering emergency shelter causes in people's lives is really drastic. It's really chaotic. It is a crisis situation for anyone experiencing it. So we want to keep as many people out of that system as possible. So we try and do that before they even hit shelter. Once they're in shelter, we have great case managers in all of the shelters who will assess people. We have a huge vulnerability assessment that we're really looking at people's needs. What do they need? They're involved in this process and letting us know what they need to make sure they get matched up into the appropriate housing option. Housing options can range from just a quick turnaround, you're back in an apartment, to longer term lifetime subsidy with case management attached to it. So really there's a whole spectrum of types of housing that we want to make sure people are matched up correctly to. So I want to talk a little bit about street outreach. I have a feeling Dan might cover this as well, or there might be questions about this. Street outreach really refers to engaging people who are sleeping outside. So we have a really collaborative approach to that. The Rescue Mission provides street outreach services in Onondaga County, so does In My Father's Kitchen. And then we try and partner with healthcare providers, mental health providers, to really engage people who are sleeping outside and get them indoors. We have an outreach committee meeting, one of our hundreds of committees, it feels like, that have all of these partners, including the police department, to come together and try and figure out solutions to get people from staying outside into emergency shelter or indirectly into housing. So 211 is there, and then the local downtown committee. So it's a good segue into 211. We partner really closely with 211. 211 is like 911, but you dial 211, and it's a referral line for services. What the homeless providers use 211 for is a direct shot into shelter, essentially. So if someone's experiencing homelessness or you see someone out in the community who you think is experiencing homelessness and you'd like a street outreach team to follow up with them, you call 211, you give a description of that person. Street outreach teams are dispatched, not immediately, but will be dispatched out to engage with that person. Our street outreach teams do amazing work. They probably know that person already and are actively working with them, but it's always good to have the community call, because if there's someone we're not engaging, we don't want to ignore that that person exists. And we're only, you know, there's only four or five people out there doing street outreach, so it's really important that our community calls 211 when they see someone, so we can really get that information. Five people can't cover an entire county, so we really rely on our community. Another one of our initiatives is SPARK, Supporting Partnerships for Anti-Racist Communities. Dan really spearheaded this, bringing this initiative into our community. What it does is it really looks at racial disparity in our homelessness system. So we have three initiatives that sprung from the SPARK initiative. to bring trauma-informed care, which is a training for people who are working in homelessness, to our community, creating economic mobility and creating better quality housing stock. So we have submitted all of our homeless data to them. They gave us back a report that we'll be releasing shortly of what racial disparity really looks like in our homeless delivery system. Okay, so I'm gonna get into some of our stats and data. What data really does for us is lets us have a good snapshot of what our homelessness system looks like. So right now we're really focused on ending chronic homelessness. These are people who have been, I won't get into the technical definition, it's really boring, but they're people who've been continuously homeless over their lifetime and have a disability. You must have a disability to be considered chronically homeless. So we're really looking at tracking the progress towards that, and our HMIS system that I mentioned before really helps us do that. We're also looking at ending youth homelessness. That's from ages 12 to 24. We really want to make sure that every youth has a home. And then using data really helps us make data-driven decisions based on what our community actually looks like. And I apologize, we're still finishing up our 2018 numbers, our annual numbers, so if you had asked me in a couple months, I'd have those. But in 2017, there were 555 households experiencing homelessness, people in households, so families. There were 3,469 individuals experiencing homelessness. So you can see there's a huge difference between individuals versus families experiencing homelessness. And then there were 653 unaccompanied youth in shelter. Unaccompanied youth might be self-explanatory, but it's anyone ages 12 to 24 who's in the shelter system without a parent or guardian. So just some, like I said, with supporting partnerships for anti-racist communities, we're always looking at racial disparity in our system. So in 2017, 62% of our homeless families were people of color. Overall, there is a 37% race disparity in our homelessness system, in our COC. So what that means is people of color are more likely to fall into homelessness based on their representation in the census data. So the point in time count, as I mentioned before, is a count of one snapshot day. So in 2018, there were 547 people in emergency shelter, 51 unaccompanied youth, 34 chronically homeless people. So we've seen a 14% decrease in chronic homelessness, a 4% increase in youth homelessness, and 1.6% increase in documented homeless people on that night. This is a little broken out by county. We gave you more stats for Onondaga County because I figured we're in Onondaga County. So we overall from 2017 to 18, we decreased homelessness by 8% looking at just that night in January. From 2016 to 18, it's decreased by 14%. And then from 2014 to 18, we've actually decreased homelessness by 28%. And that's again on that single night in January, but that's a good snapshot of our homelessness system. So we are making strides to end homelessness. And we're seeing that in our data. There have been increases in the other two counties we cover. A lot of that is because they weren't participating in our HMIS system, and now they are. So we're getting that data slowly in. So there will be increases there, I would say, for the next couple of years. Something I think is interesting to look at is 45% of all homeless children in families are under the age of 5 years old. So we have a lot of young children presenting at shelter, which I think is great. And then that's it for my presentation. There's my contact information. I'll hand it over to Dan. Thanks.
Okay, so I work pretty closely with Megan, and she just gave you the baseline information And I'm not going to give you any more data or anything like that. I'm going to tell you a story that you're going to leave here with and you're not going to forget. And I'm going to talk about ROI, the return on your investment, which is something social workers do not talk about, and they taught me zero about that at Syracuse University. So I've kind of learned the ROI as I've, trial by fire. So the rescue mission, just so we're all on the same page, and I like to clear up any misconceptions about who we are and what we do, but we are 132 years old. We do not serve the people in this community. We are part of the very fabric of this community. The rescue mission is 132 years old, serving any and everyone that's come to the doors in that time period. I'm pretty sure that homelessness is not going anywhere. Look at all of the different presidents that we've had since 1887 till now. Democrats, Republicans, money gets infused, money gets taken away, and we still deal with homelessness. So there's underlying problems that money and political parties can't necessarily fix. So you need safety nets in your community, and the nice thing about the Rescue Mission is we're the safety net in this community. We are just in Syracuse, Binghamton, Auburn, and Ithaca. And we are not a national organization. We are local for 132 years. The Utica Rescue Mission has nothing to do with us, and we have nothing to do with them, except we do similar things. But we're not governed by anybody else. The only people I report to is 14 board members that are all part of this community as well. So, and they're tough. I've got 14 tough bosses. So, So we are local, and when you give to the Rescue Mission, it stays right here in Syracuse and Onondaga County, Central New York, and we help individuals that are locally homeless. So that's a good return on your investment. I would also say that there's two things that we've been talking a lot about in the community. There's homelessness, there's panhandling. Sometimes those worlds cross, and sometimes those worlds have nothing to do with each other. Sometimes panhandlers have employment, income in place, and housing in place. If you have employment, income, and housing, and you're panhandling, the Rescue Mission might not be working with you. Our goal is to end hunger and homelessness. And so if you have those things in place, we may connect, we might try to understand what your story is, but there's nothing the Rescue Mission can do for you if you have income and housing and you're just, kind of have a side job on the corner. Now, sometimes you don't have income in place, you've got severe mental health issues, and you are on a street corner, bringing in some income. And so that's where the Rescue Mission, our outreach team, will continually go out and work with individuals to figure out what's their pathway out of homelessness, what's their pathway out of the situation they're in, and then we keep showing up. We show up and show up until we have that breakthrough moment where somebody says, all right, I'm ready to try something different. So, the story I'm going to share with you is about a man named Will. And Will was one of those individuals. He was literally living under a bridge. He was panhandling. He was pretty ornery. And anytime the Rescue Mission van would show up to talk to him, he would say, get the bleep out of here. I don't need your help. And mainly he explained to me later that the reason he didn't like the Rescue Mission van to pull up was all donations stopped. When people see the Rescue Mission pull up and start working with you, people don't donate anymore. So we kept showing up, and Will kept telling us to get out of here. And so finally one day our outreach worker said, Will, you ready today? Is today the day? And he says, get out of here. I don't need your help. And as our outreach worker was getting in the van to leave, Will said, you know what? I'm sick of this. If you can get me into inpatient treatment and a shower, I'll go with you. And so that's the moment that we're always waiting for. That's the moment where we've built up a relationship, we have enough trust, and this individual is going to come with us. And so, I don't know if you know about inpatient treatment, but it is not easy to get into today or tomorrow, and sometimes it takes a couple weeks. So, we were able to get him the shower, and our staff had to drive him to Potsdam to get him into inpatient treatment within 24 hours. So that's what we did. We got him an inpatient, and he got off the street. So Will got into recovery. He's doing much better. And just a few months ago, I said, Will, I want to take you out for lunch. I want to hear your story. That's the coolest part about my job is we have thousands of people that come through the mission, and all of their stories are different. Many of them are unbelievable, incredible. And when you hear the story, you understand how somebody can become homeless. So Will and I, we went to Five Guys and got burgers, and I said, all right, start at the beginning, because I know that you were born as a baby and you ended up homeless in Syracuse, New York. So what happened in that gap of time? And so Will begins to tell me one of the craziest stories I've ever heard. Will was born in Kentucky to Irish immigrant parents, and he says that both of his parents came to the United States from Ireland, not in search of a better life, but they were criminals in Ireland, and they came to the United States to be criminals in the United States. I said, well, I've got some Irish roots, and that resonates with me, so, you know. So his parents come to Kentucky, they have him, and at 4 years old, both of his parents are dead. His criminal mother killed his father, and then she killed herself. So at 4 years old, he goes into the care of his uncle, and his uncle, surprisingly, was also part of this criminal family. And so he said, I was raised by a criminal uncle who was essentially a biker gang member, and he raised me just as another human living in the house. There's no compassion, no caring, no role model, no father figure, anything like that. I was just in it, watching everything that he did. So right away, you can understand individuals who are homeless have traumatic life experiences. So his traumatic life experiences start at 4. If you know anything about youth child development, a lot of attachment happens between 0 and 5, 0 and 6 years old, and a lot of bad things can happen as well. So at 4 years old, he loses both his parents. And then you get to process that for the rest of your life, that your mom killed your father and then killed herself. So Will gets through school. He says he meets a nice girl in Kentucky in 8th grade, and then I think in late high school he got married. So he got married very young, he said. I think he said he was 17, and she was 16. In Kentucky, that's okay. So they got married, and then right as he was finishing high school, he said, I'm going into the military because what else am I going to do with my life? He said he went into the military. He kind of got straightened out a little bit. They make your life pretty regimented. He came out, stayed married through the whole time that he was in the military. And then he got a good job working in like the coal industry. So he's working in the coal industry in Kentucky, you know, strained family relationships, but has a wife, has two kids, and things are looking better for his life. And so he was making a lot of money, he said. They would take weekend trips from time to time. And he had to work late on a Friday. He was sending his wife and kids up to Colorado for a nice weekend getaway. He was coming up later, put him on a plane. As he wrapped up his day, he found out that the plane with his wife and kids both crashed and everyone was dead. So now Will tells me he goes to the funeral of his wife and children. Funeral ends, he gets on a motorcycle and starts driving across the country doing any and every drug he could find to medicate through the pain of losing his family. So Will ends up in New Jersey and says he meets this woman who he had no relationship with other than they did lots of drugs together, and they heard that heroin was a lot cheaper in Syracuse, New York. That is the only reason he came to Syracuse, New York, because he heard heroin was cheaper. So he and this woman said, let's go to Syracuse, we'll buy a bunch of heroin, come back to New Jersey where it's a lot nicer, and we can sell it, make some money, fuel our habit. They get in a vehicle, drive to Syracuse. He said they bought a lot of heroin. It was in the car. They stopped at a mini mart on the west side. He gets out, goes in to buy a bunch of beers. He's in there for a little bit, comes out, sees the car is surrounded by police, and he said the car was to the left, and he made a right and never looked back. He, to this day, has no idea what happened to that woman, has no idea what happened in the vehicle. He said when he made that right and walked the other direction, he started living under a bridge and panhandling for money. Every day, he would panhandle, and he told me that people are compassionate, they want to give. Sometimes he could make $100 an hour panhandling, and he would take every dollar that he got and buy drugs and inject it into his veins. And so that is when I realized panhandling and the compassion of others can have a terrible return on our investment. Will said to a room full of people at our Hope Awards last year, you know, and I didn't prompt any of it. I said, you know, share your story with whomever you'd like. And he said, the worst thing somebody can do is to hand me money because I'm going to inject it in my veins and that might be the last dollar I ever see because I just overdosed under a bridge somewhere where no one knows where I'm at, where they're not going to jumpstart my heart, they're not going to Narcan me. And so now I'm dead because somebody was feeling guilty, feeling compassionate. And I told Will, I said, well, you know, we can't put that on people and their compassion. That's still the choice you made. That's still the action that you took. And he said, oh, I agree. He said, I'll take responsibility for what I did, but if I didn't have those dollars, I couldn't have bought it. So it made me realize panhandling and homelessness, they are intertwined from time to time, but there's better ways that we as a community can help panhandlers. And when we give dollars, it might not be injected, but it might. And that injection might be the last one that they ever have. So Will's a powerful story. He's now in a job where he's helping others who are in recovery. He's still doing really well. I have this dream someday of hiring Will to be part of our outreach team, because once you've been under the bridge and you've been injecting, it's much easier for you to have that conversation with somebody that's in that situation. I mean, that's what the Rescue Mission does. We'll continue to go out to connect with those individuals, to build that trust, to get them off the street, into the shelter, and then get them back on a path to self-sufficiency and ultimately living a happy and successful life. So we've been doing it for 132 years. We partner with Megan. We partner with all the other not-for-profit agencies in the community, the human service agencies. And everybody in this community is doing really good work. And everybody has a different take on panhandling. Everybody has a different take on the dollars and how you spend it. And listen, you make money and you earn it. And if you want to take whatever you earn and give it to somebody on the street corner, I think that's your prerogative. But I'm here to tell you there's a better way to spend it. And I think you find an organization that you are compassionate about, you think they're doing good work, and give to them. And then when you roll down your window, give a pair of socks, give a water bottle, give something that makes you feel good, that helps you to connect with somebody that's on the street corner. But the dollars might not have a good return on your investment. Thanks for coming today.
And Megan. Thanks, Dan and Megan. Okay, so now it's time for questions, folks.
Good morning, Dan, Megan. Thank you both for showing up, Dan. A couple questions. Well, actually, just one. The Rescue Mission now has got several things going on down in your campus area. Can you explain what's going on down there as far as improvements, building, construction?
Yes, sure. So the one major construction project we have going on right now is the expansion of our food service center. That was built in the 70s, and at that time it was serving about 75 to 80 meals a day. And fast forward to 2019, we're serving between 600 and 700 meals a day. That's 3 meals a day, 365 days a year to anyone that comes in is in need. In the 10 years that I've been working there, one thing that we did see that didn't sit right was when people would come for meals, you would have somebody that just came out from under the bridge, somebody that was struggling with their addiction, somebody that may be high, and then a mom with her 3-year-old and 2-year-old walking in to have meals together. And at times, it's a tense environment. So with our new food service project, the Clarence L. Jordan Food Service Center, as clients come in for a meal, when they go to the left, they will eat with the general group. And then when you go to the right, there's a separate family dining hall now. And so anybody coming in with kids is going to have a different experience when they come to the Rescue Mission for a meal. So that's the main project that we've been working on. Unfortunately, there are zero grant dollars for food service projects. We've searched federal, state, local. And so we had to embark on our first capital campaign in 25-plus years. And $5.8 million campaign is about $200,000 short from completion, and that is all our community supporting this cause. So kudos to Syracuse and Onondaga County for creating this project. And we're going to have a really awesome place for people to have meals. It should open early November, but we're still doing meals. It's a mess right now, but we're getting through it, and it's going to be a great place to eat.
Good morning. I was curious if the women who are homeless are doing it for equality, because if men can sleep under the bridge, so can we, or are there different types of stories?
For sure, different stories. So the Rescue Mission does have, when we opened our new shelter in 2015, there's 193 beds in our shelter, and 50 of those are designated for women. So we have two dorm rooms that have a separate entrance for women. Prior to that, we were not serving women, but yes, we see women coming in with as intense stories as the men have, Most of them have all experienced some domestic violence and sexual abuse, and so they need different resources than the men might need. But again, what our caseworkers do is we sit down with the individual, we look at what their strengths are and figure out their pathway out of homelessness. But nearly everyone's path is different.
I'd just like to jump in and say that a common misconception, 98% of our homeless population stays in emergency shelter and not outside. It's a really small number of people who actually will brave Central New York in the winter outside. Although these are probably the toughest cases, most people will come in and stay at the Rescue Mission or one of the other local shelters rather than be out there, because as you know, it's real cold.
I have a question. Through Focus, we gave people who registered through Focus a chance to ask questions, and there were a couple of questions there. One of them was regarding whether you have provisions for helping people who are in shelters or have in homelessness to get them services to move into work situations and things like that.
Yeah, so on our campus, we have an employment resource center in our shelter building, and we have an employment resource specialist that will work with an individual to help them craft a resume that might need some tweaking, help them to look for employment, do mock interviews. Again, our community is very generous with their clothing donations, so we've got 3-piece suits that we can get for somebody that needs a job or has a job interview. We also have Carhartt clothes and steel toe boots, and we can equip any individual with whatever they need to get back on their feet and start working. But, you know, I'll tell you, I got a letter from Sing Sing Correctional Facility just last week, and this gentleman is writing, he writes to the Rescue Mission and says, you know, I've just done 25 years, and I'm going to be released, and I really just want a second chance at life, and can I come to the Rescue Mission? I've got a gentleman that went into prison in 1994. Think about 1994. Cell phones weren't a thing. I was a junior in high school, and I pretty much made it through college without really doing much computer stuff. And so now this individual went into the jail at that time, and now he's going to come into this workforce, this environment. He's got a big 25-year gap on his resume. And so we have to really hold his hand a little bit while he's sleeping in a homeless shelter trying to figure out his next steps in life. So people are coming to the mission with a lot of barriers and obstacles in their path. And, you know, we'll do our best to help each one navigate through that.
Hi. I'm wondering what services are available for non-binary or gender non-conforming folks who come to the Rescue Mission or other services in Central New York.
Well, I can say that the Rescue Mission is an affirming organization. We do, you know, people can stay in the male and female dorms as they identify. And we also have one bathroom facility and shower facility in the shelter that is locking, and it's for an individual that is trans, perhaps, and they could access that space. Unfortunately, New York State still defines a lot of what we do and how we do it. So you have to have male and female restrooms, you have to have male and female dorms. And, you know, we are continually navigating that environment, because as you and I and a lot of people in this room might be affirming to people's, you know, gender preference, the other 190 individuals in that shelter may have no scope or may have no patience for that. So our staff is continually trying to educate people. We bring in the Q Center, ACR Health has come in and continues to do training for our staff to help, you know, educate us all, because, you know, we're all learning in 2019 of the best way to communicate, the best pronouns to use, how to communicate with somebody to find out what's the best way to, you know, talk to them and begin a conversation. So, you know, it's not an ideal, a shelter's not an ideal situation for anybody, any gender, any way anybody identifies, but we do try to be as affirming as, you know, anyone could be in our environment.
And there are options for people if they truly don't feel safe for whatever reason, an emergency shelter. Department of Social Services does pursue other options for people. So really, we try and let the person dictate what would make them feel safe, where they feel the most comfortable, and try and accommodate that as best as possible as a community.
Thank you for being here. It was very informative. How does someone know to call 211, and what's the process once someone has called 211? What happens that day, that night?
So I would say if you're questioning whether to call 211, there's some really good identifying tips that someone might be sleeping outside. One is they have a lot of stuff with them. So they're not just standing on the corner themselves panhandling. They have a duffel bag, a tent, a sleeping bag, something with them that shows that they're lugging all of their personal belongings from that spot to wherever they're sleeping that night. Another one is if they're very inappropriately dressed for the weather, that can usually lead you to think that someone has a mental health issue. That's one of the most identifying things for people who are outside. So if it's cold and they don't have a coat on, or it's 100 degrees and they have six coats on, that's a time you know that they might need an intervention. Really, it's if you suspect they're sleeping outside. If it's during the day and they're panhandling, most of the time, they're guys that we've already talked to, that, you know, dance team, or women, that dance team is already engaged with. It's really if you were coming home late at night and saw someone in the woods that you wouldn't have seen if you weren't, you know, looking out the window of your car. Those are more the things we'd want 211 called about.
So whenever I see somebody out on the street, I always call I've got a direct line to our outreach team, and I've never not called, and they've always known who the individual was. So just last week I called and I said, hey, I'm near the mall. There's a woman with an oxygen tank. Yep, we know who that is. It's so-and-so. She's got a place to stay. We've been working with her. Okay, great. Anytime it's like a dog, I'm like, oh, I got a guy with a dog. I'm like, yeah, we know that dog. We brought him dog food, but he's got a house. He's okay. Don't worry about it. So yeah. I think our community, like I said, all right, this is a little known secret, but there's a panhandling problem in Syracuse, New York, because Syracuse, New York is a compassionate community. We care about people. We give to people when we see them in need. If you go to a city and they don't have a panhandling problem, I don't know, that might tell you something else about that city. But that it's not a bad thing. It's a thing that we need to change a behavior that's happening. But it's due mostly in part because our community is really compassionate.
Yeah, and I would say that 98% of the time, dance team knows who they are and we're trying to get them inside, or we know they have a safe place to stay, but we really need our community for that 2%. I heard a story recently that, oh yeah, someone's sleeping in the Tully Burger King and everyone in Tully knows about it. I grew up in Tully. I've never seen a person sleep in the Tully Burger King, and I was floored. And you think of how big Onondaga County is, we can't be everywhere. Dance team can't be everywhere. If someone called 211, they'd go down to Tully and see who's sleeping in the Burger King and try and get them services. So really, 98% we know, 2% we need our community. We really don't want anyone sleeping outside.
So if you have a question, though, just call 211 and we'll look into it.
And they'll walk you through it. They'll ask you to give a description of that person and where they are. So try your best to really pinpoint where people are, because that's where the outreach teams can go find them.
What percent of the population that are homeless are veterans, and how does the homeless population in Syracuse compare to other places around the country? Are we high, low, average?
We're extremely low for veteran homelessness. It's hard. It's all based on your population. But I would say we're around average with the rest of the community. However, we've seen greater decreases than a lot of other communities in the United States, which has been great. Our veteran homelessness has decreased every year in the past 5 years. I think we're down to, in this last point in time count, 2019 numbers, don't quote me on this because they're not official and published, but I think there were about 15 veterans in shelter, which 5 years ago there were 60. So really we've been doing some great work there with collaborations with the VA and some other community providers.
you have joined together, and you're covering a lot of communities from Syracuse to Binghamton to Auburn. Is there something that you're finding that is significant in any one particular place that is
new
to you?
Yeah, specifically, a very large problem is the lack of truly affordable housing for this population. And in Syracuse, Ithaca, Auburn, Binghamton, and affordable housing meaning we need $400 a month quality apartments. Those are not being created. The temporary emergency assistance, you know, that you can access if you're falling on tough times is $385 for housing. And that has not changed in over a decade in our community. And that's, you know, we don't have any control over that. But the housing stock that is available is not, it's very difficult to go from minimum wage or homeless to minimum wage job to paying $700, $1,000 a month for an apartment. And so what I believe we need in all of those communities, I mean, you think it's tough in Syracuse, Ithaca is, you know, probably 100 times worse because the housing stock is just gobbled up by Cornell and Ithaca College and smaller community. And the cost of living is astronomically more for some unknown reason. But we need more housing that is low income, affordable, and really low income, like $400 a month apartments.
And rural homelessness looks really different from urban homelessness. We work in Cayuga and Oswego counties, and I'll tell you, Oswego County, vast geographic region, it's very different. There are people sleeping in abandoned barns and things like that, which is harder to capture and serve than here, where we can kind of see everybody. So I think, too, Dan's completely right. Affordable housing, affordable not in what a housing developer will tell you is affordable, but truly affordable to this population is something entirely different.
And we need it all. We need purpose-built housing. We need apartments with staffing. We need more tiny homes that Andrew's building. We need all options for the homeless population because there isn't going to be one path to get us out of homelessness in the community.
I'm wondering, so the numbers are going down, it really depends on the population, right? The numbers for homelessness are going down. Can you tell us on the local level what things we have been doing that might be contributing to those lower homelessness numbers?
Well, my perspective might be different from Megan's, but some of it is determined by what HUD wants to focus their dollars on. So there, in my opinion, there is a significant decrease in our community and across the country in veteran homelessness because President Obama funneled a ton of money and resources to ending veteran homelessness. That's happening now with family homelessness. If we saw a giant dollar increase for single homeless men who are drug addicts, we could probably put a huge dent in that, but that's not as easy to fund, and it's not as easy to get a lot of support behind at the political level. So, and right now, if you've heard our current presidency and his administration, homelessness isn't really on their checkoff list right now. So we could see some of these numbers change if the dollars continue to, but again, it's like the ebb and flow of it. I do think a lot of it is tied to the dollars and resources invested. If you want to throw a lot of money to end veteran homelessness, you can put a really big dent in it. I think our community's been able to do that because of that.
I think, too, I'm going to give the flowery answer because Dan is absolutely right. It takes resources. It takes housing subsidies. It takes a lot of different interventions to get people out of homelessness. But I will say I go to a lot of conferences and I talk to a lot of people in different communities trying to do the exact same work with the exact same amount of money. And we're doing better. And we're doing better because we talk to each other, we have good support from our leadership in these communities, and we have a great collaborative, engaged citizenship in this issue. And I think that's what really pushes you over, because you can get federal and state dollars, and you can do all that advocacy, but the local advocacy and the commitment to that is what really pushes you over the edge. So I think we have some strong leaders here trying to push that forward, and I really think that our community coming together and focusing on it here, we can make a bigger difference, and we do make a bigger difference.
So I was just curious, is there a little bit of a turf war that goes on with the panhandlers? So I noticed, like at Calthrop, when you get off of 81 at Calthrop, and there'll be people there, and there used to be a girl, and then it's, you wonder if there's not also turf wars with the people that are panhandling, that they kind of run people off the corners, and, you know.
More often they have schedules. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. It's a job. They're out there and they take turns. For someone new, maybe they run them off. I'm not entirely sure, but sometimes there are schedules.
Megan and Dan, Martha Ryan here. Thank you very much. This has been very informative. Can you talk a little bit about the new initiative that the city has implemented or is implementing about working with the panhandlers to give them gainful employment for a short period of time, or whatever the details of that are, and where are we with implementing that?
Sure. So I was involved in some of that planning process. I believe it's slated to begin May 1st. And really, what that looks like to me is, yes, they're going to try and get them employed, but that's just another tool for us to provide outreach to those folks, too. Again, don't quote me. I believe May they're going to start getting going with that project.
Dan, that jersey you are wearing is a new vision in our town. Is there some significance to that? You're going to take
some
time off? Well,
it's sunny and it's opening day, so I am clocking out of work at 1 o'clock today. But I'm very excited. It's the neat thing about the Syracuse Mets, Rescue Mission was able to work out a really neat partnership, and they asked us to come on board to be the community's 50-50 raffle sponsor this year at the Syracuse Mets game. So every $50 that is donated, somebody's going to win half, and then the Rescue Mission is going to get the other half to help the homeless in our community. So I grew up in Baltimore, and so it's really tough being an Orioles fan these days. But I am all in on the Syracuse Mets, and I think, you know, the more people that come out and support the Mets, it's just a neat thing for our community. I personally asked Tim Tebow and the rest of the team if they would come and serve a meal to the homeless in our community this year, and Tim Tebow said, I would love to. So I think we're going to have a nice partnership and relationship with Syracuse Mets. And again, Jason Smorrell and that whole team, they're really compassionate people. They're part of this community as well.
Hi. I wonder if you could tell me, is there a mechanism in place, and maybe it's my ignorance, that helps direct people in the community as to what to do when? For example, I can tell you that in my job, I would say less than half of the population I deal with know what 211 is or what it offers. When I spend time on the website, I'm shocked at the amount of information that 211 provides. So that, and also, if you find someone, I've had people on the street that I've walked up to on the streets or walked up to me and said, I really just need a meal. I just really need. And so rather than giving them money, I will say, well, the Samaritan Center serves at whatever. But I don't know a lot of people in the community know the serving times or who serves meals. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with the even the panhandling. Mm-hmm. Maybe a suggestion of instead of.
Yeah. I think so. You're dead on. I'm a social worker. Megan and I work in homeless services. We know everything in the community. And how could anybody not know what we know? And we are in this 24/7. And then there's the rest of the world that is just trying to get to work and get their kids off the bus and get to a Mets game, you know? We are human service organizations, and the one thing that we're probably really bad at is marketing and the right way to market, how to get the word out. I think we all could do better, and that's a really good, it's a really good suggestion. Maybe what Megan and I could do is continue to talk with the county and the city and try to find better ways to communicate all the incredible services that are here in this community. There, you know, the Rescue Mission is doing incredible work, and there's a whole bunch of agencies that are also doing incredible work. And I think find the one that you line up with, give to them, support them, and then give them some input and advice too on how to get their message out better, because we're trying to figure it out. I mean, I dream of the day when not-for-profits don't have to, each year we start over at, actually, I might want to be one of the best panhandlers in town if you think about it. Each year, my team and I, we have to raise millions of dollars to do really difficult work. And I have a dream someday that not-for-profits are just funded fully to do this, you know, invaluable work in our communities. But until then, I'm asking for dollars, so.
I live two blocks from the former Maria Regina College, and I have a dream of seeing that turned into a sliding scale, sliding size, housing vulnerable facility. You could easily make those dorms single service rooms. You could put two or three of them together, make them family service rooms.
Yeah.
There's everything you need there. There's dining halls, there's education halls. And I'm just wondering, how would I start to do that? I have no idea. I'm just walking the dog by there going, there's the perfect spot and nobody seems to know.
Yeah, that's a great idea, honestly. And I think it's getting the right people at the table. Anytime you have an idea like that, if somebody has a different idea to make a whole bunch of money off of that kind of thing, it might win out. But those are the kind of ideas our community needs. And then when somebody has an idea like that, that we all rally around it and say, you know, this is a better way to create an option for, you know, the poor and impoverished in our community. Let's not do $1,000 a month apartments. Let's do $400 a month apartments. I think we should all, as a community, start to ask that question. When we hear about a new housing project, oh, here comes a new one in downtown, which is great, and we should encourage that, but also say, so who's building the $400 a month? When are we going to get some new $400 a month apartments? Let's start asking that question, and then maybe people will start listening.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks for the questions. And please join me in thanking Dan and Megan.
Thank you.